Thank you very much. Thanks everyone for coming. Yes, I'm drawing actually tonight from this book. It actually comes out in October. I sent it off with final edits to the press just yesterday, which is very exciting. And it collects and tries to analyse really all the known photographs of Frederick Douglass, proving he was the most photographed American of the 19th century. Until now, General Custer has held that title. A man called Mark Katz published a book of 155 photographs of Custer in 1990. After Custer, scholars cite Red Cloud, who has 128 photographs, Walt Whitman, of whom there are 127, and Abraham Lincoln with 126, all as, you know, previously thought to be the century's most photographed Americans. Whitman actually proudly claimed in his own lifetime, no man has been photographed more than I have. But we have found over 160 photographs of Douglass, so making him the century's most photographed American by the time of his death in 1895. I actually think Ulysses S. Grant is probably a likely contender. No one's published the corpus of Grant photographs. Harold Holzer is planning a book of Grant photographs, he says, but he estimated, he thinks that about 150. Actually, the only figures standing between Douglass and the title of the most photographed person in the world in the 19th century are members of the British royal family, unfortunately. The Prince and the Princess of Wales had over 600 photographs taken each. This means basically that even in the US, as a black man was considered subhuman by many white Americans, Douglass, this former slave, became widely photographed, visually famous, immediately recognisable by millions. And this was, of course, his intention, more so than any other abolitionist, any other American, really. It was Douglass who understood the implications of his country's fascination with this new technology, with the camera. He immediately recognised the democratic importance of this technology. He praised what he called its multitude, variety, perfection, and cheapness. And he celebrated its mass availability. He said, the servant girl can now see a likeness of herself, such as noble ladies and even royalty itself could not purchase 50 years ago. And historians have tended really to ignore Douglass's passion for photography, but it was there in everything he wrote. He's actually the person who wrote the most about photography in the 19th century, more so than other 19th century intellectuals. Four unpublished essays we found and transcribed from his handwriting. He really placed himself at the centre of what I think of as the country's transformation from being a textual nation, a textual culture, to being a visual one in the years leading up to the Civil War. And he really tried to use that transformation to achieve another one from a land of slavery, legalized slavery, into a land of freedom. And then after the Civil War, from a land of legalized segregation to a land of equality. Just to show you some of these photographs, this is the very first photograph of Douglass. It's a daguerreotype taken in 1841, so just a couple years really after he escaped from slavery. And this one is the last. It's a deathbed photograph, so taken the day after his death, by the sculptor who came to take a cast of his face and of his hands on February the 21st, 1895. And in between these two images, you have 50 years of Douglass. There are 10 daguerreotypes we've found, whereas previously historians thought maybe six existed. This is one of the new daguerreotypes. There's also 5 ambrotypes, whereas previously historians thought just one existed. And this is one of the newly sort of unearthed ones. And there's also 1 salt print, which is comparatively rare. This is up on the screen. There's 1 lantern slide. There are stereographs, carte de visite, cabinet cards, dry plate prints, postcards. The only major forms that are not sort of there in this archive are the British calotype, and that was quite rare in America, and then also the tintype, which was really the cheapest, the least vibrant form, I think, of 19th century photography. Speaking of Britain, just really quickly, one really surprising thing is that we haven't found a single photograph of Douglass in Europe. And that's really shocking when you think about how frequently he sat for his portrait. In the US, he sat on average once every 16 weeks from 1845 all the way through to 1895. And he spent 3.5 years in Europe, 2 years in the 1840s, 6 months in the late 1850s, and a year in the 1880s, mostly in Britain. And so it seems odd, I think, that given how much he loved photography, that he would not sit once for his portrait in Europe, especially because we have found multiple photographs that he had taken in Haiti when he was there in the 1880s. This is one of them. I think there may be a couple different reasons for why we fail to find photographs in the European archives. Firstly, I do think there hasn't been the same digitization, the same documentation of archives as there has been in the US. Secondly, photography was just far less popular here than it was in the United States. Storefront photo galleries were rare here in the 19th century, as were daguerreotypes and ambrotypes and carte de visite, which were the most popular form among the masses. The callotype was the preferred medium in Britain, and it had high cost, high labour. It didn't cater to the masses. And so most significantly, you know, unlike in the US, British photographers came from the upper class and catered to the upper class. Douglas befriended British aristocrats and elites. There's evidence from his correspondence that he did actually sit for his portrait in England. We haven't found any images. I think it's lost. But in 1859, he wrote a letter to a Mrs. Cash in Huddersfield, and he referred to a photograph that her daughter had actually apparently taken of him in 1846. But the photograph doesn't seem to exist anymore, and neither do any others of Douglas in Europe. What the archive does have, though, is images by one previously unacknowledged woman photographer, Lydia Cadwell. She was an accomplished Chicago photographer, an inventor, gallery owner. She took four just stunning photographs of Douglas while he was on a Western speaking tour in the winter of 1875. It included this one. Also two photographs by a southerner, a man called Carl Gears. He took two, including this one in Nashville in 1873. Douglas was there to address a gathering of former slaves at the plantation where they had been enslaved. Also two photographs by a recent immigrant, a man called George Schreiber, taken in Philadelphia in 1870, including this one. And images by four African-American photographers. James Presley Ball took two photographs in Cincinnati in 1867, including this. James Hiram Easton, he was based in Minnesota, actually, throughout the 1860s and 70s and 80s. He worked with his wife as his photographic partner, and he photographed Douglas while Douglas was out there on a speaking tour through the Midwest in 1869. Cornelius Batty is the third African-American photographer of Douglas. He had a successful studio in New York. He worked with a white partner, and he photographed Douglas in 1894. Actually, there are three remaining photographs from that sitting. And he went on to become a photography instructor at the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. And finally, James Reed. He had also formed an interracial photographic partnership. He teamed up with the white artist Phineas Headley. They were based in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Douglas had actually lived in New Bedford for 3 years as a fugitive, and he sat for, well, what remains from that sitting are two photographs in 1894, including this one. So the photographers of Douglas, I guess I'm trying to say, are a varied group, and this diversity is in part owing to the fact that most of his portraits were taken while on the road, so during his speaking tours. And then the sheer number, I guess, of these different photographers over the years reveals, in the US at least, the comparative openness of the profession. There were few barriers for entry to aspiring artist entrepreneurs. Startup costs were modest. It took only a few months to learn the basic process. But in addition, that's not the whole story behind this. Douglas did have a tendency to favour photographers who were African-American, who were women, who were recent immigrants, and also who were reformers or radicals themselves. And interestingly, his practice of experimenting with this sort of visual aesthetic he had is most evident when he was working with fellow activists, fellow reformers on a sitting. So he sat for the abolitionist photographer Benjamin Reimer in Philadelphia for the first ever picture of Douglas that shows more than just his upper body. So this CDV, 1861, you see a full-bearded Douglas standing holding a chair. You can see he's even got light-coloured trousers visible. First time Douglas stands up in a photograph. He also sat for the abolitionist photographer Thomas Collins. This is in Westfield, Massachusetts. It's one of the first portraits after Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. It's from early 1863. It's the first time Douglas really experiments with this three-quarter statesman pose that would really come to dominate his portraiture in the 1870s and the 1880s. So he's working, I think, with reformers to experiment a bit with his image. And he then, of course, used their portraits in turn for reform. He believed that photography was really crucial. It was a crucial aid to his vision of a free and a democratic society. And along the way, he also rewarded loyalty here in this sort of experimental process he had. The photographer with whom he took the most images, returning to this man's studio over and over again in the 1860s and 1870s, was the abolitionist photographer James White Hearn. Hearn was actually a telegraph operator in Philadelphia in 1859. And when news of John Brown's raid broke, Douglas was actually in Philadelphia and he was preparing to deliver a lecture, and an order came through to the sheriff of Philadelphia through the wire, telling him to arrest Douglas as a conspirator in John Brown's anti-slavery raid in Virginia. And John White Hearn, who was an abolitionist, delayed delivery of that message for 3 hours in order to give Douglas a chance to leave the city. And he actually worked with Underground Railroad operators to make sure Douglas did leave the city and escape to Canada and then to England. Douglas then returned the favour by visiting John White Hearn upon his return to the US. He sat for this photograph and several others on that sitting. And then he returned over and over again. He sat for some of the most striking photographs in this whole Douglas photo archive. This is another one from the 1870s. And Hearn produced more Douglas photos than any other photographer of Douglas. One thing I think probably that might be jumping out at you already, though, is how rarely, in spite of all these collaborations and these friendships Douglas had with photographers, how rarely he was photographed with other people. So with the exception of his favourite grandson, Joseph, he was never photographed with any of his children, any of his other grandchildren. And this single grandchild, who he was particularly fond of, even here, this reflects actually a professional collaboration. So this photograph came after the two of them had been performing together in Boston in May 1894. Douglas gave some speeches, and Joseph, his grandson, would perform on the violin before and after Douglas's remarks. And then they sat for photographs during this same trip. So even the only known photographs of Douglas with a blood relative are depictions of a professional, you know, an artistic collaboration as much as they are a family portrait. He was also never photographed with his first wife, Anna, the mother of his children, and only a very few times with his second wife, Helen. And those images include this photograph from 1884. This is Douglas and Helen during their wedding trip, and they're posed at Niagara Falls. And it's unusual too, because it's one of only two possible examples here of a souvenir photograph that Douglas might have taken as a potential personal keepsake. The only other potential one being this. He's posed with friends at George Washington's home, Mount Vernon, around the same time of the mid-1880s. And what becomes clear, I think, is that Douglas was rarely using the camera as a way to record moments for memory, as a way to visualise family relationships or friendships, as a personal tool, as a sentimental tool. Instead, for him, it was a way to create a public, professional, political image. It was a tool of reform. It was a piece of his argument for freedom, for equality, and for citizenship. And from the outset, he recognised photography's importance to combating white racism. He knew, as James Russell Lowell put it in 1845, that the very look and bearing of Douglas are an irresistible logic against the oppression of his race. And he shared this opinion. He knew he was the embodiment of his cause, that his very look in these photographs was an argument against racial oppression. It was an argument for racial equality. So he commissioned and he directed all these portraits, and he was quite carefully shaping his own visual identity. I think of these as a sort of visual autobiography that you can put alongside his three written autobiographies. They're a sort of counterpart. You can think of them almost as a single set of images, showing that as he wrote himself into existence with those three autobiographies, he was also crafting these multiple versions of his life and himself in pictures. He was photographing himself into public existence as well, and presenting himself as a steely visionary and a freedom fighter and an isolated hero and a prophet and an elder statesman. He believed so much that it was important to be photographed that he would seek out local studios in the many towns and cities that he visited to deliver lectures, and he would make sure to authorize and to sign his favorite, as with this one. so that the attendees at his lectures could purchase his image that same night or in the days afterwards as a souvenir. He continued this effort to circulate his photographs. He shared them with absent family members and close friends. In 1863, his son Charles wrote during the Civil War, and Charles was fighting in the Civil War. He wrote to his father to ask for autographed Douglas photos to pass around and gift to his fellow soldiers. Abolitionists wrote to him from England asking for photographs to put in their photo albums. And he gave portraits away as gifts to his new friends. He gave this just beautiful daguerreotype to Susan B. Anthony, the women's rights activist, in the late 1840s. And actually, these gifted photographs would adorn people's homes for decades. As late as 1937, the educated Josephine Washington explained she would show visitors a photograph she had kept since Douglas gave it to her as a birthday gift. Back when, much younger, she had clerked for him in D.C. during her summer breaks from university in the early 1880s. Douglas was so ubiquitous on people's walls, even before his death, artists started depicting rooms with framed Douglas images in them. This is 1889, the African-American artist Henry Jackson Lewis. He was a formerly enslaved man. He was a cartoonist for the Indianapolis Freeman. And he's made a sketch of his editor for that newspaper at work. And above the desk are two portraits. There's one of the editor himself on the right and one of Frederick Douglass on the left. And there's another drawing by Lewis featuring Douglass on the wall that was published in the Freeman, as was this one. You can see Douglass framed. This is by Moses Tucker. So he's ubiquitous in the 19th century. He used photographs as well to get subscriptions to his various newspapers, so again, disseminating them further. In 1873, his newspaper, The New National Era, would repeatedly advertise the inducement, as it put it, of a fine photograph of Douglas to any new subscriber to the newspaper. And his photographs would also help other individuals and organizations devoted to black rights. The Anti-Slavery Bazaar in 1846 offered an excellent daguerreotype of Frederick Douglass for sale. A few years later, two men who had teamed up, a shoemaker and a porter, wrote and told Douglass they had commissioned copies of photographs of him to be hung up in our parlours and the parlours of all men who are true to the bondman. They said it was a way to pay tribute to the reformers who marched in the forefront, battling for our rights as men and as Americans. Photographs promoted his talks too. After the Civil War, he became a speaker with this sort of speakers bureau organized by a former abolitionist based in Boston. And they used this lantern slide of Douglass to just advertise his affiliation to the agency and the talks he was giving. He also had new photographs taken every time a newspaper or a magazine wanted, you know, an engraving, a lithograph portrait of him to illustrate an article. Here, though, he started to face a problem, really in thinking about disseminating his portrait on a mass scale. So the halftone process, which enabled photographs to be mass-produced, wasn't perfected until the sort of early 20th century, and he had to rely instead on engravings cut from photographs for book illustrations and for newspaper illustrations, and he did not have the same faith in the objectivity of these engravers as he did in the camera. For example, in 1849, he discovered an engraving of himself, and it was cut from another engraving that possibly stemmed from a painting. It was in a publication, a widely read publication, called A Tribute for the Negro, and it was written by a British abolitionist. The engraver had portrayed Douglass with a slight smile, you can see, and Douglass was outraged. He, in his newspaper, just railed against this image. He said the portrait had a much more kindly and amiable expression than is generally thought to characterize the face of a fugitive slave. So he was no longer a fugitive at this point, but he wanted the look of a defiant but, you know, respectable abolitionist. And then he goes on to attack really the fallibility, as he saw it, of engraving and of painting. He said, "Negroes can never have impartial portraits at the hands of white artists. It seems to us next to impossible for white men to take likenesses of black men without most grossly exaggerating their distinctive features." And this criticism that he had really of white artists highlights why he was so in love with photography. As an art and as a technology, he thought it overcame whites' preconceived notions of African-Americans. He thought the camera, unlike engravings and paintings represented African Americans accurately. But he still had that problem of how to disseminate on a mass scale these photographs using this unreliable medium. And he tried to get around this by hiring only engravers he could trust. A man called John C. Boutre was his preferred engraver. Boutre did several published engravings of Douglas, including this one, which he engraved from the photograph on the left. And it's significant, I think, that that engraving I told you he hated was likely done from a painting. And there are actually no known instances of Douglas critiquing an engraving that was taken from a photograph. So he resolved this problem of circulating his likeness by sending photographs in place of sketches and paintings to be engraved by these trusted engravers. And so he authorized millions of portraits to be sent out into the world. I think, you know, it's interesting. It, to me, it suggests an attempt to commission and self-direct. It reveals his awareness of the possibilities of imagery, this attempt to control and to circulate his own image. I think you start to see the beginnings of mass media in this astute public figure, America's first black celebrity, recognizing the potential for manipulating public opinion. And as far as I can tell, it was a successful manipulation. You know, while searching for Douglas over the last 5 years in museum storage units and the archives of historical societies and universities and private collections and auction houses, I've also found him in old photograph albums of unknown black or white Americans of the 19th century. He sits there alongside family members, you know, revealing he was actually a cultural icon even in his own time. He was being collected and displayed and gazed upon as a representative American, as a work of art, maybe. This is just one example of an album. You see Douglas up on the top left. It's an attempt, I think, to make familiarity breed respect. He's using photographs to be more dignified, more elegant, more represented and displayed and seen than any of the ordinary white citizens who also embraced photographic portraits in the US as a way to express and to establish middle-class identity. He was telling the country that African Americans were every bit as worthy as of citizenship as whites. He was asserting black humanity in place of the slave thing, expressing really the contradiction of human beings as property in his photographs. Countering as well demeaning caricatures of African Americans, visual caricatures in magazines in particular. This is just one example where Puck magazine has depicted him as an ape. Another example of racist cartooning. This is Leslie's Illustrated. He's battling these racist caricatures like this. He's, you know, this image has what Douglas himself saw as the stereotypically racist features present in a lot of portraits of African Americans by white artists, what he described as grossly exaggerated features. These are the kinds of representations he was protesting, you know, throughout his life. In 1870, he observed, "We coloured men so often see ourselves described and painted as monkeys that we think it a great piece of good fortune to find an exception to this general rule." So that was one problem. As a related problem, he also encountered the tendency to depict, I guess, the extreme opposite. So rather than exaggerating some stereotypical black features, illustrators tried to make Douglas look more white, maybe as a way to sort of introduce him legibly to acceptably to their readers. So several early lithographs, he has a sort of elongated face and nose in particular. This is the frontispiece to his Irish edition of the narrative. He also denounced this image. You see the same elongation, erasure of his blackness in this London newspaper in 1846. Photographs, though, let him take back control of this. You know, he believed this was a tool of aesthetic revision. He could convert audiences to the injustices of slavery via this exemplary portraiture. So the shock value basically here is that such a man was recently held as chattel. And he was challenging at this point even mainstream views, not even pro-slavery or white supremacist views. 1862, I kept a copy of an editorial in the New York Times that proclaimed any interest in African Americans would not arise from their beauty. No writer on aesthetics has ever pretended to find either beauty or grace in the shambling African. And he was countering as well, of course, a whole other set of images that I just want to talk about briefly. And these were images of exposure, of available, wounded, exposed black bodies, circulated maybe by well-meaning abolitionists before the war as an argument for abolition, this particularly famous one of the slave Gordon, but also illustrations of branded and whipped and half-naked slave bodies. And Douglas's photographs just counter all of this. He makes himself as unavailable as possible. He chooses, for example, never to smile in his images, except for two photographs very late in the very last few months of his life. And this is one of these very late photographs. I think this is significant. It's late October 1894, and he had returned for the last time to New Bedford, Massachusetts. It's the city where he first settled after escaping from slavery. He had first lived there in freedom. This is where he named himself Douglas. He attended abolitionist meetings for the first time. He delivered his first speeches. And in New Bedford, he found this young interracial photography team, two young men, Headley and Reed. They're neither of them much older than Douglas himself was when he lived in New Bedford. And in this sitting, he broke his own rule and he smiled in what turned out to be the last photograph, actually, of his much photographed life, to the last one before that deathbed image after he had died. This is an exception, though. Douglas, throughout his life, until this moment, where, for whatever reason, he did smile, he maintained that there should be no kindly, amiable expression, that a broad, inviting, sort of communicative smile undercut dignity. And of course, if you're familiar with 19th century photographs, you know people of the 19th century in general didn't smile much in photographs. But Douglas smiled less often than Whitman, Twain, Red Cloud, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Queen Victoria, William Lloyd Garrison, Ralph Waldo Emerson. He even smiled proportionately less often than the very severe John Brown. We have 50 years of this serious, severe, sort of unsmiling Douglas. He's often inscrutable. And it's a symbol, really, of solemn, heroic, stoic manhood. And he's pushing the boundaries here of what's possible for black masculinity. He's liberated himself from this very emasculating appeal. Am I not a man and a brother? This famous image that circulated throughout the 19th century as an abolitionist emblem. He actually observed of another photograph of a sort of fellow African-American leader, and it was an image that he liked. Whatever may be the prejudices of those who may look upon it, they will be compelled to admit that he is a man. And I guess I think of his own portraits as performing that same work of compelling the viewer to admit that he is a man. It's answering, in a way, this famous question, am I a man, with this resounding yes. And actually, he would have been pleased by Obama's official presidential portrait in 2008. Obama was the first president since Nixon to be photographed not smiling broadly, you know, wide grin, teeth, in his official portrait. And actually, even Nixon was an exception. So, with excepting Nixon, Obama is the only president to be photographed not grinning, you know, not open-mouthed since Eisenhower. So Douglas, who argued that African-American leaders were a representative self and as such must counteract with a kind of solemn dignity the hyper-racist representations of the broad grin, the wide mouth, the minstrel clown, I think he would have enjoyed this portrait of Obama. Connected, though, to that choice to be unsmiling, he also made the decision to just completely deviate from the usual 19th century practice of studio photography, which had elaborate props and painted scenes, backdrops, ornate columns and landscapes, flowers and books and vases. With one exception, Douglas's photographs are really stripped down. So you don't have these material objects that would distract from what he considered his sort of monumental, statuesque self. And that's in stark contrast to photographs of other abolitionists. And his photographs are also more stripped down than those of Lincoln, Whitman, General Custer, Red Cloud, Queen Victoria. On the very rare occasion that he used a prop, he made sure it was significant. So this is one of only six photographs where he poses with some kind of object. You can just see him holding there a cane. It's a photograph in Philadelphia in April 1870. And he was there to attend celebrations of the 15th Amendment being ratified. You know, it's the last of the three amendments that tried to guarantee freedom and equality for African Americans after emancipation. And I think that perhaps explains why he chose to hold Abraham Lincoln's cane. That's what's visible in his hands. Lincoln's wife had sent Douglas the cane after her husband was assassinated in 1865. Douglas called it a symbol of Lincoln's humane interest in the welfare of my whole race. So in Philadelphia, to celebrate what he did think of as the sort of last chapter of Lincoln's emancipation, he sits with this cane just visible. Three other photographs. He does have a book or a newspaper visible. This is including in the first photograph taken after the Emancipation Proclamation, which is this one. And he stands or sits in front of a decorative backdrop just three times. The first photograph taken during the Civil War, the first photograph with Helen after their marriage, his second wife, and during one of the last ever sittings in May 1894 in Boston, which was that sitting I mentioned that also gave us the photographs with Joseph, his grandson, the only blood relative to ever participate in a sitting with Douglas. And that same sitting gave us as well probably the most dramatic exception. It's the exception I mentioned to the practice of simplicity. And it's this one where Douglas sits in this chair that has lions' heads carved into the arms. And again, I think it's a significant decision at this moment in Douglas's life to sit in this ornate lion's head chair. He's aware of his nickname as the Lion of Anacostia, which is his neighborhood in Washington, D.C. He's aware of the descriptions of himself as leonine, and he's choosing at a moment of ill health and old age to cement that leonine mythology. And he posed for at least four photographs just sitting in this chair. It's a series of photographs of Douglas the Lion, you know, holding fast to his larger-than-life place in the public imagination, even in the face of increasing physical vulnerability. And I think you do also see a small smile. And for Douglas, this does count as a smile. It's the other one of the two smiling photographs I mentioned, coming like the other one very late in his life, just months before his death. So at this moment, on his last ever visit to Boston, he looks to his legacy, I think. He's acknowledging his own mythology. It's an image, I think, of Douglas saying goodbye. So basically, you can see Douglas using props and backgrounds very sparingly, only on particular occasions, only to mark historic events or particular moments. There are no clues apart from these. There are no painted scenes of Douglas, you know, standing beneath a painted scene of a plantation, you know, nothing like that. He makes himself again inaccessible. This is Douglas hidden in plain sight. And this is again in contrast to those proliferating images of black bodies whipped or branded or kneeling half naked. This is a minimalist composition, and it's recreated the black male body as something enigmatic. This is inaccessible, inscrutable. And it's his own aesthetic. It's these often closely cropped or vignetted portraits, stripped down, free of props, where he's sometimes clearly experimenting even with different angles, trying out varied gestures. It's now clear from the various sort of clusters of images taken at a single sitting, that he was working with photographers to obtain what he considered the perfect shot. So there are three similar photographs from a sitting with John Howe Kent in 1874. You can see in this one, his overcoat is undone, it's hanging loosely. There's another one where he's done the coat up and it's fastened, but it's still creased. And then the third, he straightened out the coat. And it's this one with the straightened out coat that exists in multiple different archives. It's the one that he authorized for sale, for circulation, that he probably even signed in one version as a carte de visite. So Douglas knew basically when a photograph was particularly good, and he had clear favorites. For example, in the 1880s and 1890s, he used this photograph by Charles Bell as letterhead when sending out letters. He was likely pleased with some photographs by Kent from 1874, because he came back to Kent again in 1882. So he knew what he liked, and he recognised good photographers and returned to them. It was a quite careful and a quite consistent aesthetic, I guess, over 50 years of simplicity and the serious unsmiling face and the solitary presence. But in spite of all that consistency, I just want to turn briefly to point out, I guess, him using photography to another end, and that was to establish not the self's continuity but the self in flux. He lived at a time when the idea of whiteness as a sign of superiority, justification for oppression, really depended on believing that the self was fixed, that it was unchanging. And he saw the self instead in this state of constant evolution. And he used photographic portraits to illustrate this fluid self. He reinvented himself visually, even as he was trying to reinvent the country. So before the war, abolitionist Douglas was photographed with clenched fists repeatedly. He's in the act of fighting. This is one example from 1858. Another example, this is a copy print from a lost daguerreotype. It's also from the late 1850s, actually. The only surviving copy has these black lines across it. You can see his clenched fist just down there on the bottom right. Then comes emancipation. Oh, sorry, before emancipation, he also has these aggressive sort of poses, Douglas, with his arms folded across his chest in 1859. After emancipation, though, the arms, the fist unclench. You know, one fight, at least, is over. Here's another example of Douglas's sort of unclenched post-war, relaxed hands, spread fingers. As another shift in representation, over half of all the photographs taken before the end of the Civil War have been making direct eye contact. This is one example. He stares back quite challengingly. This was a bold choice at a moment when photographers would encourage subjects to stare off to one side. After the Civil War, though, the majority of Douglas photographs feature him in the, you know, classic statesman pose, thoughtful contemplation, his head's turned in a three-quarter pose, there's no face-on posture. Here's another post-war example. So only a quarter of the post-war photographs have the direct stare. And as well, most of those post-war sort of eye contact photos are group shots. So Douglas and other committee members, delegates, associates, where they've been photographed together. Of actual Douglas portraits, so posed studio photographs where he had control, there's only 12 post-war images of nearly 100 where he makes eye contact with the camera. So you see the sort of challenging stare transforming itself into the visionary gaze instead. You see Douglas, the fighter, the fugitive, transform with legal abolition into Douglas the citizen, Douglas the great American. It's what Douglas himself phrased in his second autobiography in its title, as a transition from bondage to freedom. So the battle shifts, basically, and it shifts visibly. It shifts from one for emancipation to one for citizenship, for equal rights. And this was a radical act, you know, of resistance. This showed that the self could never be reduced to the bare bones of scientific inquiry. He's critiquing white tendencies, basically, to lock representations of enslaved men and women into surface objectification, to depict them as scientific specimens. So again, he's shifting the boundaries within which to even represent black selfhood. And what all this amounts to, I want to try and convince you, is really the first great visual battle in American history. This is a battle between racist stereotypes or paternalism and Douglas's photographs of dignity and self-possession. It's a battle over the public image of African Americans. And it's a battle that has a huge visual legacy, and in ways I couldn't have known until we started gathering these photographs together and finding the lost ones. The majority of 20th and 21st century visual renderings, reimaginings of Douglas are indebted to his own strategies of self-representation. The many artists and the 110 muralists and the 14 sculptors who have depicted Douglas did have even brief access to some of these photographs somehow in private collections or old copies of black newspapers or library archives, and they were working from specific ones. So in the protest tradition, for example, Elton Fax for Freedom Ways magazine worked with one of the two smiling photographs, although he gives Douglas a bigger smile than in the original image. Another photograph was adapted by a black community in Chicago that was printing its own banknotes, trying to be economically separate from the rest of the city in the 1980s. They put a flipped version of the Charles Bell photograph on the $20 bill. Just these two examples, though, raise a really important issue in this sort of legacy. And it's the fact that this legacy works mainly with older Douglas. So it's actually really stark when you start looking how rarely you get pre-1870s Douglas in the legacy. So Life magazine did do younger Douglas on its cover in 1968, but this is a relatively rare exception in print culture. And the situation with the statues is just as repetitive. So there are 14 full-length or larger Douglas statues that exist. 10 of them work with post-1870s Douglas, including this one. Only 4 have reached any earlier than the 1870s for their photographic inspiration. This is one of the 4. It's a statue by Gabrielle Coren in New York, and she has explained it's based on this photograph from 1857. Far more common, though, in statuary is Douglas of the 1880s and 1890s. There's a bit more variation when you reach murals and street art. This is a New Bedford mural, and it has, as you can see, older Douglas at its centre, based on the photograph on the right. But it does, you have 2 other Douglases. It's just panned out so you can see a bit more of the mural. 2 other Douglases, younger Douglases, either side. And one of them is based on a daguerreotype from around 1852. And the other is based on this daguerreotype from around 1848. For me, though, the question still remains, you know, these are the sort of rarer exceptions where you get to see younger Douglas. Why? Why do so few artists turn to younger Douglas for their depictions? I just have a couple ideas, and you might have more. Partly, it's because older Douglas lends himself to a couple different purposes that are definitely outside the sort of protest tradition that I've been talking about. And the first is to make him a biblical figure, so a sort of bearded Moses or a wise Abraham, and this better inserts him into these Black History tableaus, versions of the Last Supper like this, where Douglas actually takes the place of St. Peter, who's often depicted as white-haired and bearded in traditional Last Supper paintings. Here's another Black History tableau of the Last Supper, Douglas the only grey hair at the table. This one's actually even inside a church. You can see Douglas the bearded patriarch sitting among other saints and apostles of Black history. Another useful element maybe of older bearded Douglas is he lends himself more easily to inspiration of history paintings. So this is a huge genre actually. It's sort of, he's a symbol of the older generation, he's an inspiration, he's a patriarch of the race. People buy and sell these as posters. It's a much earlier work, but still in the genre. It's a mural for a school in Ohio called Frederick Douglass, Inspiring the Youth of the Negro Race. So again, he's the wise man of the 1880s and 1890s. That's the close-up of Douglass. So in this kind of painting, and this whole genre of inspiration of history paintings, he's the symbol of the older generation. He's the sort of figure of the self-made man, he's a success story whose life offers inspirational symbolic power. And then thirdly, I think connected to this, muralists seem to find Douglas's sort of patriarch image more useful because they want to position him at the base of a family tree. So in this mural, you can see Douglas at the bottom of this trunk, all these later figures springing out from him. He's the Black sort of origin point. He's the Black seed, I guess, as the mural's title puts it. He's the father of them all. In this one again, you can see him there at the bottom. He's one of the ancestral roots of this sort of Black history family tree. So you have Douglas is useful as he's a biblical figure, he's a historical inspiration figure, he's a racial ancestor. But then finally, I think at least, there's also a sort of memory politics to choosing older versus the younger, more radical Douglas for a mural or a statue or a painting. Most often, the bearded sort of wise man Douglas appears in murals that put him alongside more moderate reform figures, so Mandela, King. It's as though the Douglas of the 1880s, the leader, the insider, the elder statesman, who is part of the hierarchy. You know, at this point, he's been appointed by several presidents to roles like Marshal of the District of Columbia, US Minister to Haiti. It's as though this Douglas is the safer, more inclusive Douglas, the one who belongs on murals in white neighborhoods or on downtown. He's the one with cross-racial appeal. This is a mural dominated by Gandhi and by King, and Douglas appears in the top right. That's the detail in his bearded form. Artists, though, they opt for young Douglas when they want to put him alongside figures like Malcolm X, when they want to make him part of a radical heritage. And these are often community murals, and they're in historically black neighborhoods, maybe those that have an ongoing radical presence. So the Black Panther groups have sponsored some murals in California, for example. So you see artists painting Douglas from his late 1850s era, the era when he was actually advocating defensive violence against slave catchers, when he's young and goateed. You know, he's around the same age as Malcolm X was a century later, at the height of his influence. So choosing basically that Douglas era for a mural like this one in South Central LA is the call really to the Malcolm side of Douglas, the Douglas that Malcolm X himself liked to quote and to remember, the radical Douglas of the 1850s who was advocating armed rebellion. It's the insertion of Douglas into a sort of radical protest memory. Some artists even acknowledge these very different, starkly different visual eras of Douglas pre and post Civil War. This one has two versions of Douglas, I think, and I'm going to end with this image. And there's a clear turning point where one gives way to the other. This is by Leroy Foster. It's called Life and Times of Frederick Douglass. It was installed in Detroit in 1972. And you can see Foster is interested in Douglass's various visual identities. So you have the sort of super heroic, muscled Douglass in the foreground. And then there's a close-up of Douglass the Elder Statesman in the top right. And there's a third Douglass in the middle. And there's bearded John Brown standing behind him. He's got his hands resting on his shoulders. And it's John Brown, actually, that tells us this mural's actually about a turning point. It's when Douglass himself actually had to choose between these two versions of himself, maybe forever shaping how he would appear in murals and statues and paintings. The mural actually depicts the meeting of Douglass and Brown in 1859, and the radical white abolitionist, Douglass's friend, tried to persuade Douglass to join him on the raid at Harper's Ferry, and Douglass refused. He thought it was a suicide mission, and he wanted instead to live. He wanted to work for the end of slavery another way, not to take up arms. And Leroy Foster depicts this moment as a choice really between two versions of himself, between the freedom fighter who would have joined John Brown on the left, and the elder statesman, the man who lives when John Brown does not, on the right side. And Brown has his mouth open, you know, he seems even to be talking to Douglas. He's maybe painting a picture for the pensive Douglas on whose shoulders he leans, maybe describing the kind of man that we see on the left, painting a picture of Douglas breaking slavery's shackles by force. But, you know, we the viewer know that Douglas, he turned away from this vision, that this symbolically muscled body was not put into action at Harper's Ferry any more than he ever revealed it for any camera. And he instead chose the persona of the bearded Douglas in that mural. He chose to become the wise man head of the later Douglas photographs that shaped so much of his visual afterlife in the 20th century. I'll stop there. Thank you.